Good morning. This is Dallas Townsend with the CBS World News Roundup. With Chopin's funeral march blaring in the background, Lord Mountbatten this morning made his last journey through London. Doug Tunnell reports.
The massed bands of the British Royal Air Force and Marines played the funeral dirge as Lord Mountbatten of Burma began the last parade in front of somber crowds in central London. Members of the royal family, including Mountbatten's nephew, Prince Philip, the Duke of Edinburgh, escorted the coffin to the great west door of Westminster Abbey for a final farewell. Inside the abbey, it was Prince Charles, heir to the British throne, who began the tribute to a man known by Britain's royalty as Uncle Dickie.
They that go down to the sea in ships and occupy their business in great waters, these men see the works of the Lord and his wonders in the deep.
After the reading of the psalm, those inside joined Queen Elizabeth II in a hymn of patriotism. It seemed an appropriate verse for a man who had devoted 79 years to service to Britain. Lord Mountbatten fought in both world wars. Born a prince, he lived the life of a seaman who became Supreme Allied Commander in Southeast Asia in World War II. When asked once about dying, Mountbatten told an interviewer that he hoped those who attended his funeral would not be unduly sad, but thankful instead that Mountbatten had had such a happy life. But as the coffin makes its way to his country home in Hampshire for burial, it seems that almost all of England mourns him anyway. Doug Tunnell, CBS News, London.
Lord Mountbatten was assassinated 9 days ago by IRA guerrillas. As a direct result of that crime, British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher and Irish Prime Minister Jack Lynch are conferring today in London, following the funeral services, to discuss future cooperation between their countries on counteracting terrorism. But Susan Peterson reports that this political summit may end up in a head-on political collision.
Ireland and Britain both publicly condemn the tactics of the IRA and other terrorist activities. But the problem is their common 290-mile border, which is nearly impossible to police, allowing the Irish Republic, however unwilling, to become a sanctuary for known IRA operatives. It's thought Margaret Thatcher intends to present a list of British demands. Better communication link-ups between the British and Irish armies. Extradition of terrorists from the South. The right of British police to interview and interrogate suspects held by the Irish police. Last and perhaps most important, the permission for British troops and policemen to chase fugitives across the border. But the Irish government has already made it clear it cannot give in to these demands for either legal or political reasons. Instead, Prime Minister Jack Lynch will ask for a political initiative. It is a question, he says, of getting at the cause of the matter, not the effect. There are some diplomatic sources here who feel the talks are doomed to failure, but others who still think the two leaders might settle on a common and united approach to terrorist violence. Susan Peterson, CBS News, London.
The British Secretary for Northern Ireland, Humphrey Atkins, maintains that the current security system, beyond doubt, constitutes a major stumbling block in efforts to find some form of political settlement. Congress resumes work today after its summer recess, and the matter of most immediate concern is the presence of up to 3,000 Soviet combat troops in Cuba. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee had scheduled a public hearing today on the SALT II Treaty, but Phil Jones reports that the controversy over the Soviet military presence in Cuba has now taken priority.
The committee will be in closed session most of today, receiving top secret information on the situation in Cuba. First up, officials from the U.S. intelligence agencies. The senators want to know when the troops were first spotted in Cuba and what they are doing there. One top administration official says the Russian troops are more of a threat to Fidel Castro's non-alignment status than to the security of the U.S. Secretary of State Vance will also appear before the Foreign Relations Committee today. Committee Chairman Frank Church says he expects Vance to report on just how President Carter has decided to handle this very delicate matter. Church maintains that the actual strategy of coping with this should be left to the White House. However, in Church's view, the end result has to be the removal of the Soviet combat troops. Without their removal, Church says, this issue will inevitably be linked to the SALT II Treaty and that the Russian combat presence in Cuba could delay final Senate action on the U.S.-Russian Arms Limitation Treaty. Phil Jones, CBS News, Capitol Hill.
Also coming up for immediate attention on Capitol Hill is energy. And Nelson Benton has the story on that.
Long-term energy policy is a major part of the returning Congress's unfinished business, but short-term problems will come first. The principal House Energy Panel opens an inquiry this morning into the status of winter heating oil supplies. A joint Senate-House conference committee later this week begins drafting a compromise standby plan for emergency rationing of gasoline. That piece of business has been left unsettled in the Congress since last winter. Before it quits for the year, late next month probably, Congress is also to consider the Carter administration's synthetic fuels program, a windfall oil profits tax, and how that tax money is to be used. What powers to give an energy mobilization board for cutting red tape in energy development. And a whole barrel full of other energy measures, many of which will probably seep into next year. Nelson Benton, CBS News, Washington.
CBS News correspondent Mariah McLaughlin reports that members of Congress, while they were back home during the recess, heard that voters around the country are more worried about the energy problem than anything else. That conclusion is based on a spot-check poll of members conducted over the past few days. Hurricane David this morning was demoted to tropical storm. David is now heading up over North South Carolina after weakening when it came ashore yesterday in Georgia. Eric Engberg reports from Charleston, South Carolina.
The storm turned inland near Savannah, Georgia, and from there to Charleston's coastal communities rode out winds up to 90 miles an hour with accompanying high tide several feet above normal. Homes along the ocean front, some in exclusive resort communities, were heavily damaged by wind and water. Roads were inundated, and power failures plunged much of the area into darkness. Still, most residents are counting themselves lucky. Only a few casualties were reported, and the flooding was not as severe as had been expected. Most roads were open this morning as the waters receded. David moved well inland in South Carolina during the night, and its winds diminished to below hurricane level. But its potential for causing damage remains. Now officials are concerned that heavy rains, up to several inches in places, could cause flash flooding on creeks and rivers today. Eric Engberg, CBS News, Charleston, South Carolina.
David still threatens serious flooding and heavy squalls as far north as Chesapeake Bay and into the mountains of North Carolina and Virginia. While it was raging through the Caribbean, David killed well over 1,000 people, most of them in the Dominican Republic, and now that country is endangered by new flooding from Tropical Storm Frederick. Egyptian President Sadat and Israeli Prime Minister Begin this morning announced just about all the agreements that could be hoped for. But Dan Raviv reports from Haifa the differences over the Palestinian issue clearly remain.
The two leaders told a news conference after meeting for 2 hours today that they'd agreed on a temporary replacement for the United Nations peacekeeping force in the Sinai, whose mandate expired in late July. They reached an agreement in principle, with a few details remaining, on the amount of oil that Egypt will sell to Israel. But when Sadat spoke even in positive terms about continuing the process of setting up Palestinian autonomy, he said explicitly that Jerusalem is part of the occupied West Bank of the Jordan. Begin made his rejection of that notion quite clear. Sadat said the question of Jerusalem remains open. Begin kept the tone of the news conference positive as he announced that Israel will return the area of Mount Sinai to Egypt more than 2 months early, before November 19th, to mark that second anniversary of President Sadat's visit to Jerusalem. This visit to Haifa continues until tomorrow. Dan Raviv for CBS News, Haifa, Israel.
Kidnappers in Sardinia today released a British businessman abducted 2 weeks ago, but police sources say they're demanding $24.5 million ransom for the man's wife and daughter, who were kidnapped at the same time. The price of gold was fixed in London this morning at a new record, $329.25 an ounce. It's selling in Zurich at around $328. The United States dollar improved slightly today against the British pound, the French franc, and the Japanese yen, but the dollar is a bit weaker on the world's other major money markets.